welcome to Off the Page, the podcast where we take the words off the page and into your ears. As always, this episode of Off the Page will contain pieces written by the members of the Creative Writing Society at the University of Nottingham. You can visit uncws.com to find out more about the society and to visit our blog to read even more pieces by the members. So once again, welcome to Off the Page. Hi everybody, welcome to Series 2, Episode 4 of Off the Page. I'm your host, Madeline Roach, and we have some lovely creative writing people here with me today. We have
Ravi.
And we have Charlotte.
And we have Philippa.
This is Off the Page.
So we're here today in a very warm teaching and learning building, and we are going to read some pieces for you today. So the first piece is going to be by Ravi.
Hello, this is Stormflower, a letter from a woman to her wife. My darling, the stormflowers are growing again. I can see them right now. A handful grow on your mother's grave. Their blue petals, marbled with white and gold, are a beacon of life among the snowy remains of the blizzard. I don't know how they grow in such harsh conditions. Perhaps it's the danger that lets them bloom. We were like that once. Do you remember our wedding, my love? Hidden in your home, the fire crackling in the hearth, giggling to ourselves as we wove flowers into crowns. There was a moment when we both reached for the same flower and our hands touched, like in those awful novels your brother likes. Your hand was soft and warm, your eyes brighter than the moon herself, your smile mischievous as you stole my rose from me, and I knew, in that moment, that I would let you steal all the roses you want. Not the most romantic sentiment, I know, but my heart... You know what I mean. I vowed that to you, you know, as I placed my crown on your head. I vow to love you forever, I said. I vow to protect you. I vow to cherish you. I vow to walk by your side as long as you want me there, and, under my breath, I vow to bring you all the flowers you want. 70 years since that day, and I'm only telling you now. Perhaps it wasn't important. Perhaps you already knew. Regardless, as always, I am fulfilling that vow. My stormflower, these are for you. I hope you like them.
I am soft. I am slightly sad. Yes.
I was honestly tearing up as I read that.
Oh, baby. You sent that to me this morning while I was on the bus, and I was reading it and I was like, I'm on the bus! Why would you do this to me?
You see, this is my aim with my writing, to get this kind of reaction out of people.
So you want us to, like, want to hug you, but also strangle you?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's the intention.
Perfect result. I wrote half of it in the romance lead circle, so... Come along for that kind of shit.
So the next piece is by me, Maddie. So this is called Happy Memories, and it's something that I wrote over the summer when I'd been to a zoo with two of my best friends from home. And it's soft, so. Healing spells require happy memories. That's what Nana used to say. It's not a prerequisite necessarily. Not a part of the ingredients. Salt, rose incense, 3 white candles and a quartz crystal. But Nana used to say it helped. It increases the flow of positive energy and makes the spellcaster happy. And after all, a happy witch leads to happy spells. When Kala has to think of a happy memory for healing spells or to cheer herself up, she thinks of the butterfly enclosure. It was a lonely school trip to the zoo. Her best and only friend Aisha was off sick, so Kala wandered around by herself. It was easier to be on her own than to force friendship with people who thought she was a freak. They didn't know that she was a witch, but it was an unspoken secret that sent her into solitude until Aisha, brave, potentially stupid Aisha, made friends with her because she wanted to borrow Kala's felt tips. It was the best thing that ever happened to her. Aisha was everything good in the world. The type of friend who could cheer you up with a look, a well-timed eyebrow raise. The type of friend who laughs through everything. The good, the bad, the getting told off by Mr. Michelson for passing notes in history class. The type of friend whose eyes light up when she finds out you're a witch, who immediately asks you to dye her hair bright red and never once judges you. She was a gem in amongst the rocks. But gems can be broken, cracked, and she was plagued by chronic fatigue. Days were taking off her. She'd go missing for an evening or a weekend, and Calla had to get used to missing her. So she wandered around the zoo, from enclosure to enclosure, on her own. She was used to being lonely by now anyway. She twisted the map held taut between two hands and scanned it for any remaining enclosures she had yet to see. The vibrant red of a small drawing of a butterfly drew her attention, and she headed off in that direction. After pavement paths and a few wrong turns, the automatic doors slid open with a hiss, and she parted the curtains into a bursting world of green. It was just the rush of water, distant chatter, and the barely audible flutter of the butterfly wings. She looked up in awe, letting the curtains flap shut behind her and trapping in both the wet heat and the paradise she'd stumbled into. She stepped away from the entrance, further down the concrete path that stretched forward before it turned off and disappeared into the jungle that surrounded her. All around was life. Greens of different shades that provided shelter and home surrounded the greenhouse. Here and there, they sprouted flowers. Dusty pinks, purples, striking reds. And weaving in and out of the paradise of leaves was butterflies of every colour and size. Two small red and black butterflies chased each other as Calla set off slowly walking down the path. She watched them go with a smile on her face, wondering what the gestures meant. Friendship? Courtship? There were a series of information boards at the edge of the path, but she'd rather leave it to her imagination than read them. To her, perhaps it was magic. Slowly, she continued down the path, stopping when a butterfly flew over her head. It was off-white, like ivory, speckled with black dots like vanilla scraped from the pod into a batter mix. Its wings looked paper-thin and so, so delicate. She wanted to touch them. She thought they'd be soft and barely there between her fingertips. The butterfly fluttered off, and she kept on walking. She stopped once more a few paces later and took one of the straps of her rucksack off her shoulder and brought the bag around to her front, unzipping the front pouch and retrieving her phone. It was a second-hand phone from one of the older witches Nana tutored, but the gesture meant the world. Her previous phone could only call, text, and play Snake. This one, although it was still many models behind most of the other kids, took photos and could even connect to the internet. She opened up the camera app, held the phone still, and watched through the small screen until a muted orange butterfly danced into the frame and she snapped a photo. Nana would love to see that later. She took a couple more and then put her phone back in her rucksack and secured it back on her back. She looked up from adjusting one of the straps to see a dead leaf resting upright on a set of three green leaves, open like a palm. She took a step closer, inspecting the unusual leaf. Only then, for a brief moment, the leaf opened almost as if the wind had blown the pages of a book to ruffle in the breeze, and a dazzling set of wings were revealed. Calla's breath hitched. She looked closer, waiting in anticipation for the moment when those wings opened again, even for a brief second. When they did, she dragged her eyes across the wings trying to take in the cobalt blue of the lower wings, the sandy yellow stripe above it, bordered by black bands and waves. When those wings snapped shut once again, she examined the outer wings that perfectly mimicked a brown, crisp, dead leaf. Evolution, she thought. Wow. Pulling herself away from that single butterfly and the breathtaking secret it kept within its wings was a struggle, but she managed to pull herself away to follow the curve of the path. Here, she wasn't alone. There was a family with a small daughter who tugged her father around from plant to follow the path of a butterfly. From the outside, the butterfly was pretty, if a little dull. It was a deep brown with white details, around six white rings that mimicked eyes and a set of white waves on the edge of its wings. But when it flitted from plant to plant across the greenhouse, it was a dancing shock of turquoise. Calla watched the butterfly go and watched the child chase it, her father following behind dutifully. After a while, he tugged back when the child attempted to run off and told her it was time to leave. Her big eyes filled with sadness, and she argued that she didn't want to leave yet. She wanted to stay with the butterflies. And Calla, as someone who has a soft spot for children and an affinity for magic, barely twitched her hand and sent the butterfly with the hidden turquoise wings landing on the little girl's shoulder. The child wanted to squeal with glee. It was obvious at how her breath hitched, but she kept quiet not to scare the creature away. Instead, she stared at the butterfly with the widest eyes, shock and awe and undeniable happiness threatening to overflow. Above her, her father shared a similar look of wonder before quickly scrambling for his phone from the pocket of his jeans and snapping a picture. The little girl's smile was as beautiful as the butterflies flapping about the greenhouse, and as Calla watched from a distance, her smile was equally as brilliant. So when she sits down with her incense and her candles and crystals, she never forgets the most important part, the memory of the greenhouse, the butterflies, and the little girl's gleaming smile.
That was incredibly cute. Oh boy.
I think that's one of my favourite pieces that you've ever written. Yeah. I remember when you sent it to me and I read it, I was just like, I love all the detail of like the butterflies, all the like, the way you sort of like really focus on her one memory and experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like when she was like entering like through those curtains, like I could see this place like clearly.
Were the butterflies based on actual butterflies?
Yeah, so at the zoo that I went to with my friends over summer, we like went into, well, actually, I think one of my friends didn't go in. They were like, I don't, like, I'm scared of butterflies. Like, I don't want them to, like, fly on me. So me and one of my friends went in and I tried to, like, I think I wrote it that evening because I wanted to be able to remember as much as possible. But I was, like, Googling, like, blue butterfly to try and, like, get pictures on Google Images and then, like, base my description off that because I couldn't entirely remember.
But it was obvious that it was like something you had seen rather than, because the detail was just like beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm also scared of butterflies.
Are you?
I'm terrified. I went to a butterfly thing with my dad when I was like 7 and I didn't know, and then we went in and I was like, this is the worst thing, I hate this.
I've been to like bat things at zoos which are awful because they're like pitch black, you just keep like feeling things going really close next to you. But no, but the butterflies are fine, they were nice.
They're nice to look at. I just don't want them to touch me. It's like moths. I hate moths.
Oh, I don't like moths. But butterflies are the few, like, one of the few bugs that I'm not scared of. The other ones being ladybugs.
Let's all unpack our childhood to bug trauma.
So we are now joined by our president, Matty Bird, and he is going to read a piece for us.
Where were you, Matt?
I was interviewing some people from the Frozen Ark for an Impact article.
Oh!
Wow. Impact rather than creative writing.
Yep. if I wasn't doing that, I would have been on Jubilee campus doing my PhD and I wanted to be able to come here.
Nerd.
For the...
Wow, your PhD rather than creative writing.
Funnily enough, my supervisor often says that, but the other way around. This piece is from the romance lit circle that we held the Wednesday before Valentine's Day.
It was run by your favourite committee members.
For those that don't know who their favourite committee members are, it's Ravi and Charlotte.
And Charlotte just stabbed, so...
You can't
see that, but I want everybody to know.
Name and shame.
And the task, I believe Charlotte came up with the task. It was to write a letter to a lover who came before, a romantic partner who came, person who came before, presumably before the present.
Have you not heard of To All the Boys I've Loved Before?
I couldn't remember the name of the task.
I wanted to make it gender neutral, so I said To All the People I've Loved Before.
To All the People I've Loved Before. And so I wrote this instead. No, it is actually relevant to the task. Oh, left swipe, I did not mean to reject you. But I cannot undo my most grave of mistakes, for I do not pay for my swiping privileges. I know we would have been happy together, for you said you would like me if I have a cute dog. And oh boy, do I have a cute dog. I have two, in fact, and ergo, twice your love. If only I had not swiped left. Lady whose name began with an A, I'm pretty sure. I dream of when we go back to that swing by the sea in which you pose so wonderfully. Wait, that was the lady who begins with B. You, lady who begins with A, were posed near elephants. That shawl that hung so effortlessly from your meticulously designed second photo betrayed your free-spiritedness. That would surely have matched my grounding had I not so carelessly swiped left. My greatest regret on my deathbed will surely be my swipe sinister. The devil's direction led Cupid's arrow, which otherwise was set to shoot through both our lives, away from us. Oh, my left love, why are we so right, yet so impossibly wronged by an errant finger, accustomed to reacting those less than you? Our physical lives are not destined to cross. We shall not bumble into one another to let the tinder of our love light. Do not speak to me about the plentiful proverbial fish. It may happen that our love hinges on cyberspace to bring us together. We must rely on the grind of swipes to bring our coffee to our bagels. For should we match the elite singles we are, we have an affinity for together, more than just friends, we shall find if we are to meet. For you are my lonely left.
I remember in the Lit Circle enjoying that greatly. I also enjoyed it greatly now, but I remember specifically it was one of the ones in the Lit Circle where I was like, that was a really good piece.
You always have like a nice like rhythm to your pieces as well.
Thank you. I can't take praise.
This is Off the Page.
So it's time for Book of the Week, and this week Philippa has bought in a book that she likes. What? She likes it.
And now, children, show and tell. Philippa, what have you bought in? Johnny, put your hamster away. Philippa.
I brought in some string that I found in my pocket.
Is that what you sounded like as a kid?
Yes.
Hey, I found some string in my pocket, I did. Please, sir, can I have some more?
That's what I still sound like. I've had extensive vocal coaching. Please don't bully me.
I used to love show and tell.
Cool.
I used to always want to like show shit off.
Well, what kind of things did you show off?
Can't even remember. Just fucking everything. I was like so annoying as a child. Now I have depression and also anxiety. Mood.
Oh. Ain't that a mood? So this book is called Grim Tales for Young and Old by Philip Pullman, who you might know as the author of the His Dark Materials trilogy. It's his retelling of various Grimm Brothers fairy tales. Most of them are only a few pages, like 5 or 6, and then some of them are a bit longer. There's some famous ones and some obscure ones. And then he also, at the end of each story, writes a little bit about where he got, like, found the story from, and where the Grimm Brothers found the stories from, and then a bit of his commentary on his process of how he went about adapting it. Some of them are quite funny. Some of them he's just like, this one was a bit rubbish, so I completely changed it. And I'm like, do you know what? Fair enough. So I'm going to read one of the shorter stories called The Mouse, the Bird, and the Sausage. A mouse, a bird, and a sausage decided to set up home together. For a long time, they carried on happily, living within their means and even managing to save a little. The bird's job was to go into the forest every day and bring back wood for the fire. The mouse had to get water from the well, make the fire, and lay the table, and the sausage did the cooking. But we're never content with living well if we think we can live better. One day, as the bird was in the forest, he met another bird and boasted about his pleasant way of life. The other bird only called him poor old dupe. What do you mean? Well, who's doing the lion's share of the work? You are. You have to fly back and forth carrying heavy bits of wood, while the other two take it easy. They're taking advantage of you. Make no mistake about it. The bird thought about it. It's true that after the mouse had lit the fire and carried the water in, she usually went to her little room and had a snooze before getting up in time to lay the table. The sausage stayed by the pot most of the time, keeping an eye on the vegetables, and from time to time, he'd slither through the water to give it a bit of flavouring. If it needed seasoning, he'd swim more slowly. That was more or less all he did. When the bird came home with the wood, they'd stack it neatly by the fire, sit down to eat, and then sleep soundly till the next day. That was how they lived, and a fine way of life it was. However, the bird couldn't help thinking about what the other bird had said, and the next day he refused to go out and gather wood. "I've been your slave long enough," he declared. "You must have taken me for a fool. It's high time we tried a better arrangement." "But this works so well," said the mouse. "You would say that, wouldn't you?" "Besides," says the sausage, "it suits our different talents. Only because we've never tried to do it any other way." The mouse and the sausage argued, but the bird wouldn't be denied. Finally, they gave in and drew lots, and the job of gathering wood fell to the sausage, of cooking to the mouse, and of fetching water and making the fire to the bird. What happened? After the sausage went out to gather some wood, the bird lit the fire and the mouse put the saucepan on the stove. Then they waited for the sausage to come back with the first load of wood, but he was gone so long that they began to worry about him, so the bird went out to see if he was all right. Not far from the house, he came across a dog licking his lips. You haven't seen a sausage, have you? Yeah, I just ate him. Delicious. What do you mean? You can't do that. That's appalling. I'll have you up before the law. He was fair game. There's no sausage season that I know of. He certainly was not fair game. He was innocently going about his business. This is outright murder. Well, that's where you're wrong, chum. He was carrying forged papers, and that's a capital crime. Forged papers? I've never heard such nonsense. Where are they? What's your proof? I ate them too. There was nothing the bird could do. In a fight between a dog and a bird, there is only one winner, and it isn't the bird. He turned back home and told the mouse what happened. Eaten, she said. Oh, that's dreadful. I shall miss him terribly. It's very sad. We'll just have to do the best we can without him, said the bird. The bird laid the table while the mouse put the finishing touches to the stew. She remembered how easily the sausage had managed to swim round and round to season it, and thought she could do the same. So she clambered on to the saucepan handle and launched herself in. But either it was too hot and she suffocated, or else she couldn't swim at all and she drowned. But at all events, she never came out. When the bird saw the vegetable stew coming to the boil with a dead mouse in it, he panicked. He was making up the fire at the time, and in his shock and alarm, he scattered the burning logs all over the place and set fire to the house. He raced to the well to get some water to put it out, but got his foot caught in the rope. And when the bucket plunged down into the well, so he went with it. So he was drowned, and that was the end of all of them.
Oh. It's a very depressing story.
Is it the moral?
Yes.
Is not to be a sausage?
I think the moral is to be happy with what you have.
Yeah.
Don't let other people convince you that what you have isn't good enough.
I did jot down a quote from the beginning of that story, but the quotation of the day we have in our lab. I probably wrote it down, despite the fact that I wrote it down moments after you said it. But I did quite... We are never content with living well if we think we can live better. I like that quote.
That's capitalism, baby.
I like that you wrote that down. The part that I thought that you were going to say was when the sausage slithered through the water to, like, give it flavour. I was just like, what? So they're, like, eating their friend's, like, juices.
It's not as weird as you think. Because, let me...
Okay.
Here's my evidence. There are people on Patreon who can buy the bathwater.
Oh, off. Yeah.
So, I feel
we've
like...
We've all heard of Gamer Girl bathwater, Matt.
So, I reckon the sausage had a Patreon account and was selling his juiced water, his self-juiced water, to the masses.
I respect that a lot. Respect the hustle.
So, the next piece is by Matt.
Okay, so this piece was written in the POV lit circle, and the task was to write a piece in third person in which the narrator was omniscient and opinionated. Mary was peeling potatoes, slowly. Fred was getting frustrated, quickly. Fred and Mary had been married for 20 happy years, 40 years in total. Of course, anyone who visits the house assumes all 40 years have been happy ones, perhaps because Mary and Fred are good actors, but probably because nobody really cares enough about other people to notice a typically unhappy marriage when they've got their own unhappy lives to attend to. "Hurry up with them taters," Fred demanded, entirely reasonably, truth be told. Mary, equally reasonably, retorted, "Be twice as fast if you picked up a knife as well." "Would it?" Fred asked, though only because Fred was considering using the knife not to peel potatoes. If Fred acted on every thought he had, then he would have been imprisoned years ago. But then again, who wouldn't? Mary hid a scowl behind a polite, insincere chuckle, and carried on slowly peeling the potatoes. The potatoes wish you'd hurry up and put them out of their misery. Having your skin peeled away is painful enough, without the assailant pausing every few seconds to talk to Max the cat, who it must be said was wholly disinterested in the inane conversational topics Mary chose. Max would have preferred a conversation about the international finance markets, but instead was treated to conversation about how pretty he was. Yes, Mary, mirrors exist. I already know this, was what his meow translated to. Though Mary thought it meant, thank you, you're not so bad yourself, which actually made Mary blush, indicating the kind of lady she was. Eventually, Mary finished her potato torture and boiled them to their welcome to death in a pan. The carrots were next, but they deserved it, the orange pricks. The first carrot was taken wholly by surprise, especially when its skin was fed to the cat, who was disappointed, but ate it anyway.
Sometimes I worry about what goes on in your head.
Yeah. That's valid.
Pieces about angry people.
Angry people are funny.
That's fair, but also still, are you okay?
No.
What's wrong with carrots?
Nothing, I just thought it was funny that the narrator thought that carrots deserved it.
Yeah.
After building up a reader relationship with the potatoes and their plight, I thought, yeah, carrots, fat bitches. They deserve to be killed.
It's fair enough.
It was very funny, but yeah, I do worry about your mental state sometimes.
This is Off the Page.
So at the end of the podcast, we have a serialised piece. This week, the serialised piece is by Charlotte.
So this piece is inspired by a book called The Notes. If you know, you know. Okay, this is a content warning for my piece. It includes references to violence. This is called Past the Edge of Cold Winter Until the Spring Day Comes Again. Part one, Haru. I suppose Haru thought this year would be better, but things were much more difficult to navigate now he was on his own. Most of the boys were still in high school. He'd always hoped he could graduate alongside Yuto and go off to college, but that all seemed so distant now. None of them talked as often as he liked. It was when the day was drawing to a close that Haru found himself thinking of the seven of them in that classroom. The music blaring out the speaker, the laughter and dancing would always make his head spin, as if he were stuck in a dream he knew he'd have to wake up from. Haru never thought he'd have friends like this. They practically appeared out of nowhere. Now they're apart, his head was like a broken record, playing each memory over and over on repeat, trying to figure out how they ended up this far apart. He always circles back to the day at the beach. It was the most fun he'd ever had, the most comfortable he'd ever been in himself. How could it have gone so wrong? He'd never felt so invincible. The beach, year 19. Haru was staring into space. The air was biting his cheeks, leaving light pink marks on his skin. It was the kind of cold day where the sky is still a clear, fresh blue with light brushstrokes of white milk clouds. The sun was also blinding, covering the train station in a golden haze. It's a beautiful day. The sky was always such a comfort. When Haru felt lost, he would inhale deeply, close his eyes, and lean his head back. He'd release his breath and open his eyes to a calm, endless sky. No matter if it was grey and dull or bright and blue, if the universe was still, so was he. This didn't always work. It wasn't working right now. His chest was still tight with dread and his eyes stung with the frustration of feeling anxious in what he'd come to see as a safe space. Six boys he'd met in detention. His fingers tingled like they were being pricked by tiny needles. He grew restless with his own worry and began to nervously pick the skin around his nails. All too often, he would break the skin and blood would come spewing out of the fresh wound. The pain sent a shiver down his spine. He began to use his teeth. Don't do that. The voice was small. Kaito. Haru pulled his hand away and turned to face the youngest as he stood awkwardly on the train platform, feet turned in and eyes on the ground. Haru opened his mouth to respond but was cut off by Asahi's excited yells. The train is here. The piano room, year 20. The two boys had run down the school corridor trying to stifle their laughter. They'd only had a minimal exchange of words before third period had started, but had both concluded that the other was also skipping class. They hid in the toilets when the bell rang, hands covering their mouths as they heard authoritative footsteps echo down the now empty corridor. Kaito had peeked out first, barely containing the excitement. He'd almost tripped over Haru as he backed into the bathroom giggling. "Is it clear?" Haru whispered through the laughter. Kaito nodded quickly, still grinning, eyes shining. Haru grabbed Kaito's arm and ran through the door and down the corridor. He knew exactly where to go. Haru's fingers gently pressed each key, letting the sounds consume him and fill the silence of the room. He can hear the scraping of tables against the floor as Kaito decides to rearrange the whole room. Haru keeps playing. Swallowed by the soft melody, he closes his eyes and grasps onto the sounds as if he's scared they'll slip away to nothing. When he played, he felt his soul seep into the cracks in the keys and through the hollow structure. He hadn't noticed that Kaito had fallen silent. When he peeked over his shoulder, the boy was lying on the tables with his eyes closed and a gentle smile on his face. This was how Haru felt about music. It was projected in Kaito's smile. It brought him warmth and comfort and a strength that was buried deep beneath him and that only emerged when he played. If Haru could, he'd stay here forever. A sharp sound broke through the soft melody. Haru faltered and his hands left the piano. He turned to see his teacher storming towards Kaito. Haru felt his palms sweat and his heart race. He wanted to cover his head with his hands and sink into the wall, but the fear of something happening to Kaito was stronger. The teacher pulled Kaito up by his collar, threw him backwards, and slapped him until he fell to the ground. If Haru had air in his lungs, he would scream. Instead, he launched himself from his seat and marched over, placing himself between Kaito and the teacher. It had been 2 weeks since the incident in the piano room, and Haru hadn't been back to school. He'd pushed the teacher back away from Kaito, and that was enough to solidify his expulsion. He hadn't told the other boys. Even when Riku desperately rang him in the early hours asking what had happened or asking him to come back. If he hadn't taken Kaito to the piano room, he wouldn't have gotten hurt. He didn't want Kaito to suffer anymore because of him.
Oh, yeah, I really liked your description of, like when he's playing the piano and he's kind of talking about, like, what music means to him. Like, I really loved that bit.
It was a very melancholic piece.
Yeah.
It was very... I feel things.
Yeah, I don't know why the school is so abusive.
Yeah.
That came from the source material. So I didn't make that up. That was a thing.
What source material is this, Charlotte?
It's called The Notes. It's a book.
If you know, you know.
If you know, you know. No, that actually... I basically took events from this book. I was just like, oh, this thing happens in, like, a very basic way. And then I wrote kind of like a rewriting of it.
Ah.
With kind of like a different perspective.
So that's the end of this episode of Off the Page. Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you've enjoyed it. Check out the links in our description for our SU page, social medias, and the blog. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.
I actually don't like the sausage. I love you.